love you for your graveyard eyes. I don't love you for your shaven thighs. I just love you for that beat, 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 beat it. I don't love you for your tattered ties.
Good morning and welcome to Jonesy, the show that brings you conversations with some of the most interesting people in the world of books, podcasts, radio, theater, music, food, and humor, guaranteed to entertain and enlighten. I'm the host of Jonesy, Ken Jones, no relation, by the way. On today's episode, we welcome Lainey Zumas, author of the new novel Wolf Bells from Algonquin Books. Lainey was a finalist for the 2021 John Dos Passos Prize for Literature. Her work includes the story collection Farewell Navigator and the novels The Listeners and Red Clocks, which won the Oregon Book Award for Fiction and was shortlisted for the Orwell Prize for Political Fiction and the Newcomb Award for Speculative Fiction. The novel was a New York Times Book Review Editor's Choice and was named a Best Book of 2018 by The Atlantic, The Washington Post, The Huffington Post, and the New York Public Library. Vulture called it one of the 100 most important books of the 21st century so far. Lainey's fiction and nonfiction have appeared in the New York Times, the Times Literary Supplement, Granta, Guernica, The Cut, and Tin House. And she was a contributor to the Forest Avenue Press anthology City of Weird and Dispatches from Inaris. She lives here in war-ravaged Portland and teaches in the creative writing program at Portland State University. Please join us for our conversation with Lainey Zumas, which is already in progress. Well, Lainey, Wolf Bells is your fourth book and third novel following Red Clocks, which came out in 2018. That book was a bestseller and widely praised, deservedly so. The new novel took you about 7 years to write. I'm just wondering if the success, the overwhelming success actually of Red Clocks, made the writing any more challenging or stressful?
That's an interesting question. No one's ever asked me that before.
I always try for those. I don't always succeed.
Well, you got it this time.
Thanks.
I think, since Red Clocks was my third book, but it was the first one that got me some national attention and more readers. And I think that definitely contributed to my sense when I was writing Wolf Bells of not that it would be a successful book, but that it would have a few readers. And whereas when I was writing the first three books, that was not even in my mind. You know, it's like maybe some people, you know, a couple people will read it. So I think that was a little challenging, actually, because it also, in the years since Red Clocks came out, because of all the horrific stuff that's been going on around reproductive rights in the United States, I would sometimes be contacted by people asking my thoughts, my take, my opinion. And I do have opinions, of course, on all the ways that reproductive justice is being demolished in our country today. And I'm a novelist and not a political orator or, you know, I don't write op-eds and although maybe I will one day. It was kind of an interesting, I'm not saying it was a bad thing, but it was sort of being put or being invited into a role that I hadn't been in before. And of course, it made me think more about the political tendrils and ramifications of what I was writing about in Wolf Bells.
Yeah, that actually leads to my next question. It was written during a time when legal abortion was under siege, Red Clocks. And that sparked the world building you do in the book, Near Future U.S., where there's a parenthood amendment that grants rights to every embryo. There's a pink wall that prevents women from coming from the U.S. to get abortions in Canada. Abortions and abortion attempts are harshly punished. That book now seems sadly prescient, though in hindsight, you didn't take that big of a leap at the time.
No, I mean, because also, I mean, the personhood amendment, which I kind of stumbled upon back in like 2010, 2011, 2012, when I started not only researching Red Clocks, but researching IVF, because that was something I was going through personally, infertility treatment. And I found things by, you know, Mike Pence and Paul Ryan supporting this thing called the personhood amendment. Because it not only would ban abortion and make it illegal to both for doctors and patients, but also it would ban in vitro fertilization because the embryos had not given their consent to be moved out of their home in the uterus or the,
It sounds awfully ridiculous now, doesn't it? Yeah. That these people actually believe that.
Yeah. Yeah, it does. And so at the time, I was really fascinated by that and of course wanted to bring it into the book. I never thought at all. I mean, it never occurred to me that it would become a viable political possibility, but it is now. There's a lot of states that have personhood amendments either, you know, on people are really trying to bring them to votes and bring them into state assemblies. And yeah.
Well, that gets us to when you started this book. It was 2017, so it was under Trump 1.0.
Yeah.
And you were reading about the deportation of immigrants, children getting separated from the parents at the border. While many of us were angry and disgusted, for you it was more personal. You said it caused an agonizing fear.
It did. So my son, who's now almost 13, but he was 4 or 5 at the time, and he's autistic, he's nonverbal, and because of the ways in which our culture makes it difficult for non-speaking people to get their needs met and their needs known, I kept thinking, well, what if that, you know, what if he was in one of those cages?
What if he was separated from
you
and your husband?
And despite the fact that, you know, I have a lot more privilege than a lot of the folks who were, you know, being arrested at the border and having their kids taken away, that feeling of what would happen? You know, how do we all fail so terribly to take care of one another? And those kids, especially reading about families who weren't able to find out where their kids had been taken, and the kind of terror that must have been for those parents and caregivers and friends. And so, yeah, I think that's where I sort of started to imagine, well, what if a kid like my boy were, you know, in a cage somewhere or in custody, terrified. But what if someone could help him escape? I really kind of went there, again, for my own sort of wish fulfillment, but also then thinking about narrative and its possibilities and how different kinds of escape narratives work, right? And why they're important.
Well, we'll get into all that. I wanted to mention another influence on the book, which is your love for the Gothic.
Yeah.
And in Wolf Bells itself, you name check the Gothic novel Vatek, which I'd never heard of, by William Beckford. It was published in 1786. He actually has a very strange bio.
Yes, he does. Yes, he does.
So what attracts you to the Gothic and how did that influence Wolf Bells?
I first started getting really into Gothic literature in college. You know, in terms of being a sort of punk-leaning, black eyeliner-wearing person, aesthetically, it appealed to me. But also, I studied it a little bit and was interested in the ways in which themes of the uncanny and haunting and enclosure and sort of being trapped or buried, how those things were connected to broader political questions. And in the case of Vatek and this writer, he was, you know, his family had connections in Jamaican sugar plantations and enslavement. And I think that his, and he also was sort of infamous for building this huge folly or ruin of a house that, you know, maybe only he and his servants lived in. And
well, very influential in the book, it seems.
Yeah. Yeah. So that was, you know, just sort of thinking about that, but and also thinking about a kind of more recent Gothic, like early 20th century Gothic novels like The Awakening by Charlotte Perkins Gilman, and how that was specifically looking at gender and the ways in which women's interiority would be pathologized. And, you know, she was She herself, that writer, was considered hysterical and had to undergo treatment, as did Virginia Woolf, another one of my
idols. I have some questions on Virginia Woolf, some of the quotes. Mm-hmm. Now, I can see the Gothic influence, obviously, in the book's very first chapter, a brief one, describing the house that's at the center of the story. This is the first sentence. Here at the brink of a forest, on a cliff above a river, in a valley between haunches of limestone, was a steep, brown ship of a house. Like music, huh? A beautiful sentence.
I love how you read it,
That reminded me of a fairy tale beginning, and the book was had somewhat the feel of a fairy tale. There's even two children who come across this house in the woods, like Hansel and Gretel, but without a witch. And in Red Clocks, you actually have a witch who lives in a house in the woods. So there seems to be a fairy tale element in both books for me. Is that conscious on your part, or... You think that's kind of hovering?
I think it's absolutely apt. And I think that it's only really in hindsight that for me as a writer, I can sort of see these things retroactively. You know, when I'm drafting and imagining, I'm sort of in this space where I'm not really thinking outside myself or what's on the page. But of course, I have inherited all these stories and, you know, both culturally and things that I've studied, and being a feminist who's interested in ways of framing women's disobedience and the witch figure, and also, you know, women's power and people's fear of that. And so I think those were absolutely influencing me as I wrote, but I wasn't thinking of Hansel and Gretel or any kind of specific fairy tales when I actually was typing.
No, I just kind of picked up on that. Yeah. That is interesting. no breadcrumbs, but... Right. Now, the book's dedication introduces one of the central themes, perhaps the central theme. It's dedicated to everyone this world wasn't built for. And the house serves as a place for those who have no place, as a residence and a refuge, a community beyond the family, the nuclear family. There's a line in Red Clocks, which I think also applies to the house in the new book. You use the line, the solidarities against the perfects of this world. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I just see that play out in the house here.
Yeah.
So from one book to the other, there's this kind of string.
Yeah, absolutely. And of course, I think, you know, writers have certain fascinations and obsessions and anxieties that kind of move through multiple works. And already when I was writing and revising Red Clocks, because I was the mother of a disabled kid, I was starting to think about normativity and normativity, quote unquote, merit, perfection in really different ways than I thought about them before, and becoming more profoundly critical of a culture that sort of wants everyone to look the same, move the same, have the same sorts of brains. And often those are based on a sort of white, cishet, non-disabled man. So the kind of intersections between disability justice and racial justice and gender justice and kind of gender and sexuality being identities that are so policed in our current culture, all of those things went into my thinking about Wolf Bells and what kinds of spaces might be available, not just to tolerate people who weren't the winners of, quote unquote, of our society, but
the perfect,
right, the perfects, but really to welcome them and embrace them. And again, thinking about ideas like radical hospitality, not so much the specifically Christian version of that, but more just a kind of spiritual and ethical covenant, you know, the idea that no matter how different or similar someone is to us, we embrace them and we welcome them.
And that's what we find in the house. It's described in the book by the owner, Kaz, as a vibrant, multi-generational community. That's true of the characters, from young adults to an 89-year-old Holocaust survivor. Only two of them are related, Kaz and her mother, Adeline. And you have an interest in how to organize ourselves in groups other than a traditional family, where people are connected more by shared experience than blood. At the Powell's event for your book launch, you mentioned the book Abolish the Family by Sophie Lewis. The subtitle is A Manifesto for Care and Liberation. That's kind of what you're imagining in Wolf Bells.
Yeah, it is. I mean, when I read this Sophie Lewis's book, which is amazing and I highly recommend it, it really was that sort of thrill of recognition, because I read it fairly recently once I'd finished the book, but it was, it feels like a companion to the
book. Oh, you only read it after you finished? Mm-hmm. Wow.
Yeah. Yeah. It had been, I'd been kind of hearing about it for a bit, and then I finally read it this year. And yeah, it was just that pleasure of seeing, you know, kind of someone thinking alongside this and through the same questions that I have and that I'll continue to have beyond this book. But yeah, the notion of family as being defined in such a narrow, limited, prescriptive way, which is, and to have, you know, biological parents who are usually straight or who all live in this sort of one house together, isolated from other people, it's become a way to live that some people think is the only way to live. And it's not, right?
Certainly the prescribed role.
Yeah, exactly. And it's a great way to live for a lot of people. And, you know, as I said at the Powell's event, I live in a house with my partner and our kid, and we don't have pets. We don't have other people living in the house with us at the moment. So I too am sort of part of that kind of normative looking social arrangement. But I think that one thing I love about living in Portland is a lot of people here are thinking beyond that.
And, oh, yes.
And just thinking about group living and communal living. And
yeah, I had a friend who was interested in an intentional living community.
Yeah, yeah.
Especially as she ages.
Yes, exactly. Because that's a huge part of it, this notion of once we become elders, becoming disposable, you know, in the eyes of society, like, and, you know, remembering like my dad before he died, begging my siblings and I not to put him in quote unquote a home. Just don't put me in a home. I don't care where I go. I just don't want to be.
With the irony of the word home there.
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah.
It's not exactly what we would think of as a home. It's really kind of almost a prison for old people.
Yeah. Yeah. But that idea of being warehoused somewhere,
yeah.
And sort of kept alive, but not allowed to kind of be connected to a community or. So again, what I appreciate is how many people in Portland are insisting on thinking about those questions, and especially, you know, being active in mutual aid also, and sort of thinking about neighbors and neighborliness in a different way. You know, I think of the organization Street Books, which I'm sure you're familiar with.
Oh, yes, Laura Moulton.
Yeah, and how the kind of neighborly act of saying, hey, here, you know, we have some books, we have some Narcan, we have some, you know, reading glasses. Like, what could you use, right? And it's a regular thing. It's a sort of known where their bike is going to be.
Right. And she would say it's not just the books or the Narcan, or sometimes they give out socks and clothes. It's the sense of community.
Yes. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And the sense of kind of, we're all workers among workers, we're equal, right? It's not this kind of top-down hierarchical sort of arrangement, which again, with in our current horrific you know, state of affairs in American politics, there is so much of, like, you know, the no kings was selected for a reason, right? This idea that a lot of us feel like suddenly there's just this, I mean, it's always been hierarchical in terms of mainstream government, but
this is pretty bad.
This is pretty bad. I mean, really, it's just this feeling of like, and of course, you and I are sitting here talking the same week that Portland has been called war ravaged by not our president, and that he wants to send troops here, right? And yeah, it's really hard to not see this as like a bad script for like a Netflix movie. You
know? So it'll never get made, I guess.
Yeah.
Somebody will reject it. Now, yeah. Kaz is the owner of the house, as I mentioned. She's the great-granddaughter of the man who built it. He was a sea captain who was mourning his wife, died of the Spanish flu, and wanted to build a place near her grave. So that's kind of a gothic setting,
yeah.
Right there.
Yeah.
Now, Kaz was a school teacher, and she had a drug habit after ODing in the school restroom. She spent time in rehab cleaning up, living in a halfway house, and it was a wonderful experience for her, where all the residents were equal and everyone had a place. she wanted to recreate that with the house in the book. And Lainey, you had a similar experience?
I did, yeah. Many years ago when I went to rehab for drug addiction, I lived in a halfway house two different times, actually, for 4 months each in St. Paul, Minnesota. And it showed me a way of being in the world that I hadn't known before or understood before. A place where, yeah, we were all living in a kind of kinship. We weren't related to each other. We weren't.
You had this in common.
Yeah,
though.
But we had this in common, and we were also there to help each other and try to keep each other safe. And sometimes that worked, and sometimes it didn't work. But it was an incredibly beautiful way of living with other people, and because it was in the context of people who are recently clean and sober, it also had a stigma to it. And it had a, you know, there was some shame involved in it. And I think those two things, shame and stigma, are also really important things to think about when we talk about creating a society where everyone actually is welcome and equal, that things like, you know, talking about disability, for instance, not as something shameful, but as a natural part of the human experience and, you know, the diversity of human experience. Like, that's starting to, due to a lot of people, you know, who have been active and, you know, writers and disability activists, that's starting to happen. But I think we're a long way from realizing the potential of that.
Now, we've talked about, the book is very much about community and inclusion, a place for those with no place. But the second chapter of the book, right after the short chapter describing the origin of the house, centers on exclusion. A resident of the house is being asked to leave, in other words, kicked out by Kaz. Why start with that scene? I didn't notice it at the time, but it interests me after finishing the book.
Yeah, it interests me too, especially because I didn't realize until after, you know, the draft had been handed in and the galleys were printed, that part of why I wanted to start with that was a sort of technical engineering problem with the book, where I wanted there to be this empty room, that, you know, a recently vacated room.
What you call the soundproof room.
Yes, the soundproof room. And so really I had to work backwards and think of like who would live there and then think
and
of
how,
like,
he set up the room.
Yeah. And also why he couldn't stay. Right. Uh-huh. And so that is when I imagine some kind of pretentious bro, you know, who sort of holds himself over other people. But you're right. It's a friction, right, in this ideal of this utopian or paratopian house that Kaz has built. And I thought while I was writing it, and I still think it's really important to have those imperfections and contradictions and unrealized ideals as part of lived experience, because there's no purity test here that would work. You know, it's people sort of doing their best and sometimes failing. And that's also part, I think, of a political imagining that will help all of us, is that nothing's going to be perfect and it's not going to always work right. But if we're too worried about it not working, then we won't try. And as that sounds a little corny, but I did think about that a lot in terms of, you know, this woman Kaz and her friend Vara, like, they're not heroes. They're not angels. They're just people who are kind of creating this community and not always doing it right.
Let's talk about the structure of the book too, which like the house at its center is arranged by rooms. We mentioned the soundproof room, the dining room, the kitchen, the library, the living room, which you call the fishbowl in the book, the infirmary, the sunroom, downstairs bathroom, the rooms of the individual residents. So the novel's structure, for me, is good architecture. It's form following content.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it's kind of form making content manageable for when I was writing it, because I tried a lot of different ways to structure the sections. And
oh,
and
how was what were some of the original ways you tried? In Red Clocks, you do it by characters.
Yes, and I did try that characters. Here. Uh-huh. I tried it by character, saying, okay, I'm going to have the first, you know, fifth of the book be Kaz and the second fifth be Marika, or, you know. And one of the reasons that didn't work very well is it was hard to get that kind of polyphonic sort of multi-person feeling that I wanted the house to always have, that, yeah, you can have privacy there, be alone, but there's always people around and there's always people's sort of demands and complaints. And so finally, and this came during revision, I mean, it took me a long time, but finally I decided just to do it room by room. And
you said at Powell's that you even drew up a floor plan.
I did.
You were playing around with architectural design software.
Yeah, I was. I was. I love that. I mean, I have no skills at it, but it's really satisfying. Even just, you know, drawing the fishbowl as an octagonal room and seeing where the windows would be and sort of imagining the...
You also mentioned you were trying to imagine the smell of each room and kind of infuse the chapter with that.
Yeah. Yeah. The smell and to have certain, certain sensory details of like which rooms would the dog piss in and would like that smell be
Phronsie
the dog. Yeah. I don't think this made it into the final version, but the people were voting on what to name the dog and someone wanted Frida Kahlo and someone wanted Phronsie. And so they came up with Phronsie.
Now, narration is polyphonic, but it's not in first person. It's third person close. So we're kind of inside the head of the character that you're talking about in the room at the time or from their point of view. And this, of course, allows us to get learn a lot about them, get inside their heads, things that they're not talking about, but maybe feeling or perceiving. What's the advantage, though, of doing it in third person rather than first? Third person you also use for Red Clocks, but the listeners was first person.
Yeah. In a lot of ways, it was simply what I was capable of doing at the time. When I started writing Wolf Bells, there were sections I was writing in first person, depending on what I imagined the voice of that character to be. And I realized a couple things. One, that I would have to spend so much time and energy making the voices different enough from each other to be worth it, right? To have these different narrators. Because I find it unsatisfying if I'm reading, say, a book with many characters who are all speaking from the first person and they all sound exactly the same. But so in a way, it was giving myself an easier way to write it, actually. And the longer
I still think the character's personality comes through.
Oh, yeah, totally.
That's especially true. We'll talk about James, the autistic child.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, and using free and direct speech is really important to me, you know, bringing kind of a character's voice and diction and syntax into the third person narrative. But also, I liked the idea that there was this omniscience that was just kind of the house itself and the history of the house. And
in fact, there's some... chapters that seem from the point of view of the house.
Yeah. They're the house or they're kind of a sort of consciousness hovering above the house who like knows everything about the house. Yeah. So third person allowed me to do that.
Now, in Red Clocks, you told the story through four characters. So there was the biographer, the mender, the daughter, and the wife. And by my count in Wolf Bells, there are 12 residents, mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Each with a part in what you call a chorale ensemble project where everyone is equal in the eyes of the house. Now, that's a big challenge, even if it's in third person and not first.
Yeah. Yeah.
You have to know so much about those characters, what they're thinking and they're feeling.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so I made a lot of notes. Again, much of this material never made it into the book, but about the characters and like about words they would use or food they liked. And it wasn't so much writing a whole biography of each one. It was more about a lot of sensory stuff. Yeah, like how they spoke or how they experienced cold or temperature. And I like to make a lot of word lists. And I just do that in general. I keep lists of words just...
Just words you kind of are fascinated by and you might want to use in your book?
Exactly. So I would go through my lists and say, like, whose word would this be? And so sometimes the characters would kind of come more alive just from the found words that I was giving them.
Now, I want to get to some of the characters individually. We talked about Kaz. She's the owner of the house and great-granddaughter of the sea captain who built it. She was inspired by her time in rehab, recovering from drug addiction. An experience she shares with you. She also was in a fairly popular punk band in the 1970s with her friend and the house nurse, Vara. And she shares that experience with another character, a character in your first book, the listener's first novel, Quinn, who also played in a punk band. And you were in a punk band?
I was in a couple different ones. The only difference is we were not successful in the same way Kaz's was. Yeah.
Now, she's a bad pun. She's instrumental to the story.
I like that. Okay.
But probably the heart of the story is the character James. Mm. He's 8 years old. He's autistic. His mom is in jail, and he's in child.
Well, his mom's not in jail, but his cousin's mom is in jail, and his mom has temporarily lost custody of him.
Oh, yeah. Okay. Estelle is...
So Estelle is his mom.
Oh, his mom.
And
okay.
Then...
Because she's actually in the book.
Yeah, and Nola's mom, who's like the aunt, you know, Stella's sister is incarcerated.
Okay,
yeah.
But still he's in Child Protective Services. And Nola, who's not much older than James, rescues him because he's being neglected. And she takes him to Kaz's house for refuge. She knows about Kaz because she did a musical performance there. And I love that the review in PDX Monthly of the book calls James the most gorgeously rendered character I can remember reading. And he's based on a main inspiration for the book, which is your son, who's also autistic and non-speaking. Mm-hmm. So you channeled a lot of your son into the character James.
Yeah, I did. And you know, the character isn't exactly like my son.
Oh, of course
but
not.
But certainly, you know, one of the things I got inspiration from is sort of watching my kid interact with the world really on his own terms, especially in terms of sensory experience and the kinds of things that he notices that I might not notice, the ways he responds to certain kinds of stimuli that are really particular to him, and also the sort of ways he likes to be mischievous. Like I really wanted James to have some of those.
He's always running around.
Yeah.
And, yeah, but I noticed some of those. He's very attuned to smells. He often hears spoken words all running together. That's how you portray it. So da-da-da-da-da-da-da, like that, even though it might be 10 words in a sentence.
Yeah.
He's fond of the cold, calmed by hot chocolate, and fascinated by a toy keyboard. Where'd you get all these tales? Some from your own son, or maybe some other autistic children you've met or reading?
Yeah, I mean, I think some were, you know, from my own kid, and some were also just imagining kids, you know, sort of writ large, right? Because I think one of the interesting challenges for a fiction writer with any character that we're writing who isn't exactly like us in terms of, you know, biography and how we move through the world, there is a certain amount of kind of, you want to be both particular and, I won't say universal because I think that word gets sort of used in a simplistic way, but thinking of the character as an individual, right? With their own sort of set of
not
desires and needs.
Not representative of every autistic kid
precisely,
in the world.
Precisely. Yeah, because I think, you know, representation of disabled characters it's few and far between, right? And sometimes when it's done badly in the sense that they're kind of either a mascot or a token or sort of condescended to. And again, a lot of the writers who are doing the best work in counteracting that are themselves disabled, right? And I speak as a non-disabled person who is really invested in representation. And as I was writing this, I was thinking like, well, what if I don't get it right, you know? But this gets back to the observation you just made of like, well, what does it mean to get it right when everyone is their own person,
right?
So it's not that like, if I'm writing, say, like a white woman, I have to get it exactly right. And what's a white woman like, right? Because I think whiteness is a default setting, for example, in a lot of characters or, you know, in movies or TV, we forget like, well, that's an identity too. And people aren't as worried about like getting that right because it's seen already as a norm, right?
Right.
So I thought a lot about all of this and that was part of the sort of vulnerability of publishing it because it is very personal.
You felt the responsibility.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I love the line that Nola, Sir James' cousin, says about him. The problem was not that James was autistic. The problem was that society wasn't built for him. The world itself was the reason she had to worry.
Yeah.
Yeah, because he's not normative.
Exactly. Yeah, and I think that that's, you know, there's a quote elsewhere in the book, a David Graeber quote about, you know, the hidden truth of the world is that I'm paraphrasing, I'm going to butcher the quote, but the hidden truth of the world is that we made it, we built it, and we can make it differently.
Yes.
Right. So that a lot of the things that get essentialized is just the natural way. And, you know, I've had conversations with family members or friends who talk about capitalism as, well, there's no other way. Like, what else could there be?
Yeah, very naive.
and I think that's a really, I mean, there's a lot of interest invested in making people think that capitalism is the only way that we can live. And of course it's not. But I think when it comes to so many questions around how to take care of people, that unfortunately, it focuses on the person, like, okay, the person's the problem. We need to deal with the person rather than, like, how can we change the environment so that the person's more comfortable in the environment?
We're going to go from the youngest in the house, James, to Marika, who's 89 years old, survivor of the Holocaust. She grew up as a Jew in Greece, and her sister and brother were shot by German soldiers during the war. After the war, she was housed in the Feldafing camp for displaced persons, but I'd never heard of it, but I looked at it. It was the first all-Jewish displacement camp. You're from a Greek-Jewish family, Lainey. Is that how you learned about the camp?
I mean,
I thought I knew stuff, yeah. but apparently ignorant.
I am from a Greek family, but not Jewish. My father's family, they were Greek Orthodox Christian. And in part, in researching my own family and my father's ancestors, I did come upon some of the things that had happened during the Holocaust in Greece itself. In my own ignorance, I hadn't really figured Greece into the landscape of, you know, Jewish people living there. That was their home, and then being displaced and murdered. And so I think because Greece itself is personal to me, that was like where I started imagining this character, Marika. And in doing more research about some of the Jewish communities in Greece, especially those that were hardest hit by deportation and massacre, that is where I came upon the Feldafing camp. And because a lot of, you know, people just like Marika had gone there.
And it's just perfect to use a camp for displaced persons. That's really what the house is, a house for displaced, a little better than Feldafing, I'm sure. Marika's experience growing up in Greece then gives us the book's title, Wolf Bells. You have a beautiful passage in the book from Marika's point of view, Lainey. Would you read it?
Marika's grandmother had come from mountains where they once protected their goats by making noise. Hand-cast brass bells were tied by suspension loops to leather collars. The strongest and fastest villagers had worn the collars around their necks or held them like tambourines and followed the herd, dancing and shaking, a roaming wall of sound. Wolf bells. The purpose was to draw the wolves toward you and away from the sick, slow, old, or very young stragglers who would have been, without this interference, easily picked off. Wolf bells protected all members of a herd, even those who couldn't run, even those who were close to death. They could die in comfort, not drenched with terror in the jaws of a beast.
Oh, my. And that's pretty much behind the title of the book. It's beautiful.
Thank you.
And of course, that's Kaz's reason for the house, a refuge for those with no refuge to protect the most vulnerable, as you say, the weak, the slow, the sick, the too old and the too young. And you riff on the wolf bells in the book. There's the epigraph, which comes from the title of an album by the band Wire. And that goes, a bell is a cup until it is struck. And later in the book, there's this line from Marika. You had to be loud, not nice. You had to make noise, shake the bells, so the wolves would think twice. She's learned the hard way, huh, through her life experience.
She has, yeah. And the kind of wisdom and knowledge and insight she has are soon to be gone, you know, with her in terms of this character, she won't be around that much longer. And yet she sees in the little boy, James, a lot of her own brother and wants to kind of make a little bit of noise.
And to protect him.
Yeah, to protect
him. She wasn't
him.
Able to do that with her brother.
Exactly, exactly. And I think in terms of, you know, silence and noise, like the idea of that kind of auditory or audible protest and resistance. Obviously, it has so many correlations into, you know, our current political moment. And I think that was what influenced me, too, to come up with this idea of the wolf bells, because it's so much easier to be quiet. And a lot of us are socialized to be obedient and complacent and, you know, that,
or afraid. Or,
yeah. Or afraid, or
they want to
exactly
be safe.
Exactly. And I guess I'm thinking the obedient and complacent. I'm thinking more of people who sort of are not the direct targets of some of the most oppressive measures,
yeah.
You know, that could speak up and don't, you know, and
I could very well become direct targets in the future.
Yeah. Right. And even if not, even if like someone is so safe by because of their wealth or their race or whatever, even if they're never going to be a direct target, that's still the need to speak. Right. Because I think, too, getting back to your observations about abolish the family, there's a lot of political rhetoric that uses the family as sometimes it's the only reason, say, a politician or a person would take action. You know, I think during the Me Too movement of male politicians saying, well, I have daughters and I have a wife. And I would always think, well, so what? Like, what? Why do you have to have daughters in order to see the injustice here, right?
Right.
But often, you know, we do kind of think, I think a lot about, too, you know, the discourse around guns in this country, you know, and how someone can say, well, I need a gun to protect my family. And people are supposed to accept that, even though having a gun can put many, many, many more people in danger than just one's family.
Or somebody says they have daughters and yet they support a pedophile for president.
Precisely. Precisely. Yes.
So they're not connecting the two.
Yeah.
I want to get to, you had mentioned Virginia Woolf, and I know at the PALS event you talked about your love for her work. Another kind of maybe crazy observation, but is Wolf Bells kind of a shout out to her, like Wolf with two O's?
Yes, it is. It is indeed. So
not so crazy.
It's not crazy at all. And in fact, that's where the title comes from, is the fact that so Virginia Woolf's her name was Virginia Stephen, and then she married her married name was Woolf, and her sister Vanessa Stephen's married name was Bell. And so I used to see there, and Vanessa Bell was a brilliant artist in her own right and a very, very close to Virginia Woolf. And I used to kind of look at their names together and just think Wolf Bells, Wolf Bells, Wolf Bells. And,
wow. So it's kind of been rolling around in your head for a while there.
Yeah. Yeah. It's, I have a, I said I collect words, and I have one document on my computer is just titles. And that was a title like Wolf Bell or Wolf Bells. And then once I didn't originally think of it for this book, but
oh,
once
that's
I'd
what I was going to ask. Okay, because you'd figure you had read that and then, oh, that's perfect title for this book. That's what it's all about. But you had the title already.
Yeah. And then the book started getting written and I thought, oh, wait, that's the title.
Well, it's amazing how much kind of destiny or fate goes into the writing of a book, or how much your subconscious is bringing up and making connections and associations.
Absolutely. Yeah. And a lot of lucky accidents.
Mm-hmm. Now, again, on Virginia Woolf, you had mentioned that all your writing is very much influenced by this quote from her. Style is a very simple matter. It is all rhythm. And I think, Lainey, that's one of the delights of reading your novels. They often work more like poetry, more like a song, actually, like a song that has the music pull you in, almost independent of the lyrics. Was that influenced by your time in a band? I mean, it's very musical.
Thank you very much. That is really wonderful to hear. I do think a lot about sonic affiliation and rhythm and cadence. And when I write and, you know, read aloud my work a lot when I'm revising. And I think maybe, I mean, you know, I played drums when I was younger and in some bands. And
so rhythm is extremely important.
Yeah. Yeah. And I also often when I used to play drums or try to remember, you know, my parts, I would see them visually. Like, it's kind of impossible to describe in any precise way, but the rhythm became visual. And I think that's a similar thing that happens sometimes when I write, is that there is a little bit of that, kind of cross-sensory.
Like a synesthesia?
Exactly, yeah. A sort of semi-synesthetic dynamic going on. And I think that is the way. And often if I'm writing a sentence, I'll pick a word based on how it sounds and like how many syllables it sounds. Like I might be drafting and I don't know quite what word I want in a particular place. So I'll just write one syllable or three syllables and then come back to it because I just hear it that way. So
that reminds me of the famous story about Paul McCartney writing Yesterday. He had the tune and he originally called it Scrambled Eggs.
Oh.
Because it's the three syllables.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then he figured, I'm not going to put that on the record.
Sounds a little better to say
Yesterday.
Some
better lyrics.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, but it was exactly like that. You know, I looked up that Virginia Woolf quote and as part of it, she also added, now this is very profound what rhythm is and goes far deeper than any words. So you're writing the way you place the words, the sound of them, the number of syllables, it just kind of transcends the sentence itself.
Mm. Well, and I think, I mean, I definitely experience that transcendence when I read Virginia Woolf. And there's a gravity and a kind of texture and a layering and a meaning that is not available at the semantic level. But, you know, as you mentioned earlier, you know, you could have music doing some things that the lyrics aren't able
right.
to do.
And they often do. I mean, you look at some groups like Yes, whose lyrics
okay.
are totally absurd,
yeah.
but they fit the song.
Yeah.
And you still like the song.
Yeah. 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 And songs have their own emotional registers. I mean, this sounds so obvious to say, but I think we as writers can try to do the same thing, right? Because the language itself does things to the brain, right? And particularly, you know, right now I'm teaching a class on defamiliarization
at
Portland State to my grad students. And, you know, we were just talking last week about the fact that you can have a sentence that carries the correct information, but the way it carries it will change the information, right? So it might imprint it in a different way.
Is that the rhythm of the sentence then?
It could be rhythm. It could be, syntax, which actually is another aspect of rhythm, I think, especially disrupting the sort of rhythm you're expecting to hear in terms of how words go together. But also, changing up the architecture of a sentence so that it kind of comes at you almost obliquely. Yeah, all of that is really a kind of internal, like whether or not you're hearing it aloud, you can sort of hear it inside your head.
Oh, definitely. And it came through for me definitely in Wolf Bells. It's just a unique voice that you had that was, I mean, independent of the content of the book, was delightful to read. I mean, such a pleasure, even though a lot of what we read in the book is not so pleasurable. Yeah. I mean, the meaning of the words. And when I read, in quotes, Red Clocks, I did what I sometimes do. I listen to the audiobook I get out from Libby and then read the ebook, you know, to kind of continue. And the reader of that, oh man, I forgot her name.
Carissa Vacher.
That's it. She was so good.
She's great.
Well, of course, you had written the score and she was performing it. And what a team. It was just a joy to listen to.
Oh, that's awesome.
And again, it's not a very pleasurable story.
right. Yeah, I think that's a lucky thing. I also, the woman who reads Wolf Bells, Jen Lee, has a beautiful voice and really kind of got the book. And I think was able to voice it in a great way.
You know, it's funny because when I do radio and I read from a script or something, there's a rhythm that I'm listening to when I listen back that, again, is independent of what I'm saying.
Mm-hmm.
It's just how you say it.
Yeah.
And I think a lot of spoken word, a good spoken word, acts that way.
Yes.
So if somebody's reciting poetry, well, that's an easy example. But anything, even a newscaster reading the news, if they've got the stops in the right place and it just flows.
Yes. Which is, again, we were talking earlier about, like radio plays and, radio theater. And there's so much that we don't need to see in order to get the emotion and the gravity of a pause or the way that someone's voice moves is already giving us so much.
Right.
Yeah.
Now, in addition to rhythm, which is very important in your work, you've also very aware of what you call the materiality of the body. And in fact, at Powell's, you were in conversation with Lydia Yuknovich, who has corporeal writing. So yes. She's also very attuned to that. In other words, the characters have bodies and you don't shy away from the sometimes gross details, bodies like all of us have and go through the functions that all of us have, though we don't talk about them all the time. So there are bodily fluids and smells and even a few fart jokes, some good ones. And one especially memorable scene for me, of Vara in the downstairs bathroom with a bad case of constipation. I won't get any more graphic than that, but it was so well done. I think that just helps make them more human and vivid for the reader.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and you know, speaking about like the particular versus the universal, I mean, I think our bodies are something. I mean, our bodies vary so much in, you know, size and shape and the ways they move and how they feel to us. But all of our bodies have some shared needs, right? And those are often, the shared ones are often the ones that we're not supposed to talk about or, you know, that aren't sort of in polite company. And so it is kind of a cool way to think about ways people are connected, actually.
Yes, it is a connecting mechanism. Mm-hmm. I mean, I've had some constipation in the past. I haven't gone as far as Vara, but
that's good.
You think about it.
Yeah.
People are going to want to read the book now just to find out what she did in that bathroom. There's a lot of other good stuff in the book besides that scene. And your previous novel, Red Clocks, we mentioned it takes place in a world where abortion is illegal and in vitro fertilization is about on its way out. And there's a character there, the biographer, who's trying hard to get pregnant through IVF, and another character, a teenage girl, the daughter, who's pregnant and doesn't want the baby. In Wolf Bells, Kaz, who runs the house, can't have children. She had a tumor at one point, and doctors removed her uterus and her ovaries. But she doesn't want children, but still, she has a very strong maternal instinct towards the residents of the house, and of course, the two children, Nola and James. So some of your characters desperately want children, some don't, but that maternal instinct, the empathy and the caring isn't limited to birth mothers.
Absolutely
not. Yeah,
made
that very clear.
Yeah. And in, say, Anglophone literature, American literature, British literature, so many narratives hinge on a woman's body reproducing or not. And if it's done under the sort of aegis of marriage, right? Often that is the woman's entire storyline, or that is the central drama of the book.
Scarlet Letter.
Yeah, exactly. And that is so both frustrating and narrowing, and it's kind of intimately tied into, I think, the reason that all of these kind of anti-choice crusaders are temporarily at least succeeding in repealing and rolling back rights, because I think the more we accept these narratives that, well, a woman's highest calling is to reproduce and to have a biological child, like, first of all, it's just not true for a lot of people. But also if we have that narrative rolling around, then that calling is going to be, you know, is going to trump all, you know, anything else, a person with a uterus chooses to do in their life, right? Whether it's a job or simply being alone, right? Like wanting to live by oneself, just not wanting to
being called a spinster.
Exactly.
Well, actually, it's the woman who's more stigmatized than the man.
Yeah.
I don't think there's a word like spinster that applies to males.
No, because bachelor has a lot more positive connotations.
Oh, of course, yeah.
Freedom and like sexual, like playfulness. And yeah. And so someone like Kaz, who she's herself had 4 abortions and she did have ovarian cancer, and like she's had no interest ever in kind of physically reproducing. But of course, her ways of caring and for people in the world, and even just like the verb we have, like to mother, right? The verb to father simply generally just means to impregnate someone,
right?
It just does not mean to then, you know, like
to
care
father
for
a child,
person.
But to mother a child has many more connotations.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. And so maybe we kind of just, we all need to practice some new words, you know, for caring. And I mean, the word care also, I mean, it's a beautiful word, and it also gets used so much that sometimes it loses a little bit of its valence, you know. But really, yeah, to to kind of peacefully abide with one another can be kind of a different way to approach it than saying like someone's mothering someone else.
Right.
You know?
One last question, because this was interesting to me in the book. At your palace event, you mentioned you wanted to be an architect growing up. The design of the book, and you drew floor plans and all that, is for the house at its center, kind of shows that. In Wolf Bell's, Cass thinks making any kind of art was like being an architect of debris, not of buildings. And there's a quote, the garbage of your life, you can give it a shape. And later in the book, you write about Nola, she was a knife again, an architect of debris. And you also mentioned something I hadn't heard about, but the Salon of the Refuse, Salon des Refusés in French around 1860s, where great painters today were rejected by the mainstream art galleries at the time. So they got together and they started their own exhibition for rejects. Yeah, they proudly used the term. And the trash was the treasure. That's really interesting. So sometimes people can be thought of as refuse or rejects, and they're really great art.
Yeah, and I think, that idea of something that's been thrown away or disposed or is disposable, you know, someone I'm really influenced by is the French director Agnès Varda, and her film The Gleaners and I, that's the English title, is all about people who find things that have been thrown away and use them. And whether it's like actually gleaning in a field that's already been picked over.
Well, the Watts Towers in LA were built that way.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And it's much more than just like, oh, this is environmentally sustainable. I mean, although it is, I mean, that it is kind of reusing and recycling is important, but it's also an aesthetic and a mindset to say like, this still matters, even though it has been, it's not seen as useful or productive or efficient or.
And that's why I applied it to people
who
might be rejected. They don't fit into the cultural or societal mode. Again, this normative
exactly.
mode, and they're a little different, but
they matter just as much.
And,
and the fact of, something that I love about that, that film, The Gleaners and I, and just the kind of aesthetic of gleaning is it's about searching for the things that are not supposed to matter. It's not simply like, oh, I know they're there, I accept it. It's like, no, I'm going to find them and I want them, right? It's kind of switching the values.
Right. And then by mentioning the Salon of the Refused, you look at the great painters that were rejected and actually formed this, and the ones that were accepted by the art galleries, and it's totally reversed now. those painters have the reputation now. That's what you see in museums across the world. But I don't know if you're going to see too much of the paintings of the people who are actually considered societal artists or...
Right, the successful ones at
successful
the time.
Successful artists, yeah. Mm-hmm. There was a mode that they had to fit into that they didn't. Well, Lainey, thanks so much for talking with us today and for what I think is another important, insightful, and compassionate book.
Thank you, Ken. Thank you so much for inviting me. It's a pleasure.
Well, that's all for this episode of Jonesy here on KABU Community Radio. If you missed any part of the show, would just like to hear it all again? You can stream this episode and previous episodes online at kboo.fm/program/Jonesy, Jonesy, or just search for it on the KABU website. Before we head out the door, a big thank you to our guest today, Lainey Zumas, author of the new novel Wolf Bells from Algonquin Books. For those of you in the Pacific Northwest, if you'd like to see Lainey in person, she'll be at Third Place Books in Seattle tomorrow, Friday, October 10th, the Bainbridge Book Festival on Saturday, October 11th, and the Portland Book Festival on Saturday, November 8th. You can learn more about Lainey, the new book, and all her events online at laineyzumas.com. Jonesy, by the way, comes to you every other week on the second and fourth Thursdays of the month from 10:30 to 11:30 a.m. Tune in for our next show on Thursday, October 23rd. I'm your host, Ken Jones, no relation, saying, hope to see you all again then.